We'll get to the top overused words of the year in a moment. Right now, we're wrapping up our conversation about writers in exile. Azar Nafisi is with us. She's author of a number of books, including Reading Lolita in Tehran, also Edwige Dantica. Her new book is titled Create Dangerously, The Immigrant Artist at Work. And Chandrai Hove is an author and poet originally from Zimbabwe. Let's get one more call in. Jay is in Otterbach, Germany. Hello there.
Yes. Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I'm sort of a different situation. I'm actually recently retired from the Air Force, and I was a professor in English at the Air Force Academy, and I chose sort of to put myself in a year-long exile to write, and because I find that it's that distance that gives you kind of the perspective on some of the insanity in a way that's going on in our own world, but I should say our the United States. But
so you've self-exiled yourself from the U.S. to write about the U.S.
Yes, exactly. I'm blogging also about war literature, which is sort of my specialty, but I'm also a fiction writer. And, you know, historically, getting perspective and sort of stepping back and hearing different voices around you, it's like being in your own imaginative bubble in a way. You hear all these voices that sort of work through you in a different way, I think, when you're out of your own place. And I'm also a pilot, so I'm fascinated with this notion of distance and how our imagination works differently with distance. And I'm interested in what your panelists had to say about that.
All right. Well, Jay, thanks so much for the call. Edwige Dantica, do you think there are things you can say about Haiti that you just couldn't have had you stayed there? And not just politically, but just things that you wouldn't have even thought the same way or looked at things the same way.
Probably. I think there's the value of distance, as we've been talking about, even linguistic distance in my case, because English is my third language. So there's a level of sort of social politeness or level of fear of offending that you benefit from. For example, I always say that I have a year, for example, between translations of my book, and I cherish that year because I get a year to worry, you know, not to worry about being in trouble until the translation comes out a year later. So there's a certain level of freedom that perhaps one allows oneself that one may not from inside the language or inside the culture. So that's something that I've always thought as possibly one of the consoling benefits of being in a situation where you're outside of the place where you were born.
Mm. Chandrai Hove, who do you write for? Are you writing for Zimbabweans or at home or abroad like you, or for Westerners, or do you think about that?
I actually, to be honest, when I'm writing, I just want to express myself sincerely about a subject. I cannot stand up and say I write for so-and-so or for Zimbabweans because they didn't elect me to write. I write because I have my conscience which says I should write certain things, which are certain stories or poems, which if I don't, I will feel burdened the rest of my life. But what I'm also doing is by communicating with myself in my writing, I will also, in the process, discover the other. I will resonate with others, with other people who read. So in a situation also when, for example, in my country, the economy is in rather bad shape, you cannot assume that people can afford to just walk into a bookstore and buy books. And publishers cannot even sometimes afford to publish the books because it's so expensive. So I really write in search of myself and in the process also search and find other, who is the reader, whoever it is.
Azar Nafisi, the same question to you. And I'm wondering also, though, if social media has changed this. We learned during some of the demonstrations last year in Iran that quite a few people are on Twitter and, the Internet over there. Has that changed who you feel your audience is?
I, like Chandra, I feel that I call the readers strangers who, through sharing the same passions and dreams, become intimate in strangers with you. So my readers are, I don't know where they are, because the only place where there are no boundaries of nationality or ethnicity or language is the realm of imagination. And so that is the realm where I work. But social media has changed means of one level, which is information, but still to know, to put yourself in place of how someone feels in Zimbabwe or Haiti or New Orleans or Iran, you have to experience the story. You have to have the feel of it. And for that, you go to the land of imagination. I just wanted to say one small thing. Up to now, we've been talking about how we can illuminate our past or the places where we came from. But I think some of the greatest writing has been also about writers like Conrad or Nabokov, who have illuminated and given us fresh views about the new countries they adapted. Nabokov's best work was about America, and it was written during his period of exile in this country and later in Switzerland. And I think he could see this America through the eyes of his Russia, and even Russian language glimmers through those amazingly light-filled scenes in Lolita or his other works. So it is not just that other country that comes to us. This new country is also nourished because language is also a home. And when you change that home and come to a new thing, you'd love to play with it. And that's what I love about English. I can play with it.
All right. And I think we have to leave things there. This has been fascinating. Azar Nafisi is the author of Reading Lolita in Tehran, a memoir of books. Her forthcoming book is That Other World, Nabokov and the Puzzle of Exile. She joined us here in Studio 3A. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
We also were joined by Edwige Dantica, the author of Breath, Eyes, Memory, and the Farming of the Bones. Her latest book is Create Dangerously, the Immigrant Artist at Work. And Chenjerai Holve, the author and poet originally from Zimbabwe. He's now a writer in residence for the City of Refuge program at Miami-Dade College. And you both join me from Station WLRN in Miami. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
When future generations look back on the events of 2010, will they wonder if the anger and rage over the spill cam led to the presidential shellacking? Or will they say, huh? Whether you don't know what some of those buzzwords mean or whether you're tired of hearing them over and over, new words do make their way into our language every year. The Global Language Monitor tracks them and just released its list of top words, phrases, and names of the year. In a moment, we'll hear more and how those lists were compiled. So tell us, what's your top word, name, or phrase of 2010? Call us at 800-989-8255 or email us talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. Joining us now from member station KUT in Austin is Paul Payek. He's the president and chief information analyst of the Global Language Monitor. Welcome.
Good to see you.
So spill cam, number one word. Not BP, not oil spill, but spill cam, all one word. How did you figure that out?
Well, what we do is basically track the English language globally. We track billions of web pages, billions of blogs, tens of thousands of social media sites, and then 75,000 electronic and print media, meaning most of the newspapers and television stations in the world that have databases. What we do, we observe them all year long. We see which words are making the biggest news and how they change in time. We measure them from the end of last year, 12/31/09, and then we measure them again in after 3 months, and then 6 months, and then right before we release the survey. And these lists are in different categories and shows you what have made the biggest changes over time and what have the biggest impact.
That sounds incredibly hard. Social media,
it is.
You have to just keep doing it.
But you know, these things kind of self-organize. It's interesting. It's you know, global English is a very democratic language, and new things kind of bubble up. We don't have an Academy Francaise that tells us what's correct and what's not correct and what words we can use. So when you see a word like vuvuzela, which you couldn't invent if you're writing a science fiction novel, right? I mean, it's like quite a word. And then you just go out and do a Google search on it, and there's like millions of these things in every language around the planet. I mean, a word like that, I guess there was a need for a word like that to describe this one oddly colored horn that that made its impact at the World Cup.
It's better to say the word than to hear that annoying noise.
it's very, very, and we could link to the sound, but we figured let's save everybody on it. But spill cam, I mean, it's like you have to test it. Is it BP spill cam? Is it spill cam? What's used the most frequently? What are people using on blogs, which is close as or social media, which is as close to normal conversation as you can get, right? And what's actually being sped? What's actually being said? And it turns out that it was spill cam. Which we happen to think was like the world's worst PR decision when, you know, some PR a hack said, you know, we could always show them that spill cam. We do have a camera down there, right? We can show it live how we straightened it up, right? And so that also ranks as one of the worst PR decisions in history.
All right. Give us some more of the list. What are a few other words?
Okay. I mean, it's like, of course, refudiate, right? You know that's going to be a big hit as soon as it comes out. But the interesting thing is when Sarah Palin use this word, which is a conflation of refute and repudiate, is that, you know, the language is large enough, you know, with millions of words. And we say a million, but there's millions of English words. And that if you go back and search the literature, you always find the word. And people immediately found two or three references to repudiate from literature 30, 40 years ago.
So really?
Kind of interesting. Yes.
So she did not coin it.
She did not coin it, but she certainly popularized it.
Ah, isn't that interesting?
And then the narrative. The narrative, of course, has been very interesting because the narrative seems in politics. You know, in academic studies, people have been studying narratives and all for years. You know, we all remember the narrative of Frederick Douglass, et cetera, et cetera. But what happens with the narrative in politics, this has been going on for probably four or five election cycles, but it's peaking now, is that people talk about the narrative. They don't talk about platforms anymore. And it's almost like
a party's narrative, right? The political party's narrative.
Right. It's like, does this fit into the narrative? It's like, wait, what about a platform? What about like ideas? What about, you know, these truths we hold to be self-evident?
Is narrative a fancy word for spin?
It's getting that way. It's kind of interesting.
Let me just interrupt here briefly to say you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Now, when you put this list together, were these words that kind of went beyond the U.S.? It seems very U.S.-centric and politically centric because of the midterms, I guess. But were, you know, was the Times of India talking about the spill cam and refudiate?
Yes. Yes, we do. It's a global English. It's every place there's an English database we could track, we track. And then we will actually go into different sections. We can go into different type of media, like the electronic media and newspapers, and actually, you know, just focus in on a subcontinent or China, whatever. And you'll see the same things happening. It's like the U.S., for better or for worse, is leading the growth of global English right now. And our words show up very readily every place you go. We just saw that one of our top words from a few years ago was Brokeback. And we
from
just saw
movie.
One of our friends in China called this from the movie Brokeback. Okay. And it seemed to be at the time like a non-offensive way to say gay. And it were all kind of spoofs on the movie. Remember the New Yorker had a cover cartoons, etc. Anyhow, but one of our friends in Beijing just told us that they have a new urban dictionary, which is like college dictionary. And it actually has Brokeback and ideograms now.
They
made it into a Chinese word.
Meaning homosexual or gay?
Meaning gay, right.
So these things do happen. Because I have to say, I'm looking at the list and, you know, Snowmageddon, I just don't see that having a long shelf life.
That probably doesn't. That's probably a word that comes and goes. Some of these things have shelf lives. Some of them don't. But most of them will have a spot in history, like Obamamania, right?
Right.
When we talked about that a few years ago, people said, but what if he doesn't win? Well, if he doesn't win or if he does win, it just means the definition will change. But we know if you're studying the election of 08, you're going to have to encounter Obamamania, even if you look at that 1,000 years from now.
Okay, I got to say I was stumped by number 10. I guess I just missed this. What is simplexity?
We always try to get a couple jargon words or soon-to-be jargon words, okay? And this just hit the threshold that it was popular enough that we could use it. And basically, it's a paradox. You try to simple the complex, okay, in order to make it easy to understand, the process of which makes it even more complex and nobody understands anything.
where was
now,
that
it's actually
used
supposed
widely
to not do that, but that's what happens.
Where was that used widely that I missed?
Well, it's in technology.
Oh, okay. Of course. Okay. Gotcha.
Of course, everything's, you know, they bubble over from technology. Sometimes they win, sometimes they don't.
You also do top people names list, and Hu Jintao is topping it this year.
Yeah, that was interesting because out of the top 10 stories of the top stories in themselves of the first decade of the 21st century, China, the rise of China was the number one story, you know, beating 9/11 and Iraq war and all the tsunamis, all sorts of things. And so it's kind of fitting that President Yu, or as we call him, the paramount leader, is actually in the news that much right now. He tries not to be. He tries to be just one of a bunch of leaders. But the interesting thing we think is that number two is iPad. So that actually tells you how successful that is.
Speaking of, let's get a quick call in. Carl is in South Kona, Hawaii. Is that Hawaii?
Yes, ma'am.
Go right ahead.
Yes, I was very. I'm hearing half the radio, so I better turn it down. Turn it off.
Always, turn the radio down there and tell us what you're.
It's really hard. Okay, so sustainability. The word sustainability. Now, I've heard it from people who in all walks of life, and I don't care what, whether they're Republican, Democrat, independent, whether they have an agenda of some kind. The word sustainability is being really tossed around.
Okay. Let's see. Thanks for the call, Carla. How did that rate?
Actually, that rated as the number one word of 2006.
Oh, so.
It's been deeply embedded into the language.
All right. Well, Paul Payback is the president and chief information analyst of the Global Language Monitor. He'll be listening to what you say coming up. He joined us from member station KUT in Austin. You can see the full list of top words, terms, and names at our website, npr.org. Click Talk of the Nation. Thank you so much, Paul Payback.
Great to be here. Bye-bye.
Tomorrow, are we seeing the death of traditional journalism? Ted Koppel will join us. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Jennifer Ludden.